Hundreds of families left homeless by the volcano and not by choice. How do we help them cope with the loss and the short-term and long-term stresses? Joining us in studio live is Troy Freitas, who is the state's behavioral health disaster coordinator. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I wasn't aware that we had someone that coordinated programs in the event of a disaster.
Yes, my role is primarily to be a vehicle to communicate between the Substance Abuse Mental Health Service Administration and the State of Hawaii Department of Health Adult Mental Health Division in responding to disasters that are specific to people's ability to cope with the disasters effectively.
And so tell us, you know, we've seen some cases of stresses on the Big Island. I think we had a suicide. We had the really startling video of the shooting between neighbors. What's being done to help people in this time of need?
There are mental health workers that are in the shelters on the Big Island, giving information out to the public as they would like information available to them. There are mental health workers who are continuously updating the information that they find that the public needs based on the questions that they're asking at these shelters, as well as the administration in the Big Island or on the Big Island, as well as in the Adult Mental Health Division, the Department of Health. We want to try to keep the information as relevant and meaningful as possible as people make their needs, as they express their needs.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked to a photographer who goes up in the air every day to see, you know, where the lava flow is headed. And he says as part of his therapy, he actually posts some of the video on Facebook just so his neighbors can see, you know, is my house still standing? Has it been consumed by lava? Because, you know, folks really want to know because they've got this connection. It's their home. And then to have that loss, it's pretty traumatic.
Yes, and very normal. And just wanted to note, when you use the word traumatic, that's very different to be traumatized than to feel very stressed and uncomfortable and afraid. So what we're trying to do is direct people to resources, mental health resources, that's going to provide them what support they need for the kinds of symptoms that they have, including trauma if needed.
Right. I mean, because what they're experiencing is really a loss. You know, they've got to grieve. I mean, it takes a while to kind of get your head wrapped around the idea that you don't have a home to go back to.
Right. And that grieving process, and maybe even the word despair, is very, very normal. So being present for people when they're ready to express those feelings is a lot of what we do and what we're going to continue doing as people reach out and actually express those feelings, because it is also very normal when working on adrenaline as your way to kind of keep moving forward, to not express those feelings until you feel that your basic needs are met, that you have a place to stay, that you're going to have some food to eat for yourself, your loved ones. And so when they're ready to say how they're feeling about it and what help they're willing to accept, we want to offer them every and anything that we can in referral or direct services as needed.
Right. And I know, well, there was that term, misery loves company. But, you know, when you see other people going through the same thing and you can, you know, give them a hug or a pat on the back, or, you know, the volunteers that are out there manning the shelters and you know, I think they're all concerned because this is our community and we're just watching over this drawn out period, this tremendous hurt that's happening.
Yes. And as you had mentioned, the people that are trying to help those who are going through this maybe more direct effect of the volcanic eruptions, they're needing help too. And they are being reminded about their resilience, although that resilience does need a break sometimes. And so caring for the caregiver is also part of the equation. So for the people and for the caregivers being affected by this, or the helpers, the people in the helping profession, it's an opportunity to remind one another about the resilience that we all have in us, but that sometimes having somebody be by your side and just listen to the narrative that you're going through, the story that you're willing to share with someone, helps a human service provider or any kind of provider remind you of the feelings being normal, remind you of your social supports, whether they're through your faith or from your family, that is available to you and wants to kind of be with you through this and work through this together in redefining your hopes and dreams. Because a lot of people's hopes and dreams are attached to their house.
Right. And I know we've got, you know, a situation where things are moving very fast. It's very dynamic. And so maybe, I don't know, what's the best advice? Just take a break, you know, maybe get out of the environment that you're in if you can for a little bit, just to kind of refresh and get your mind clear.
Yes. And I'll give an example. Sometimes for people who aren't going through a very stressful event like what's going on through the Big Island, but are stressed from their everyday experiences, sometimes they don't remember to take a deep breath until somebody actually prompts them. So whether it be taking a deep breath or just taking some kind of a short break and being away from a lot of stimuli, whether it be a smartphone or anything else, is really important to be reminded of. And also just for those who are, you know, that group of folks I'm saying running on adrenaline, especially being aware of your caffeine and alcohol intake, because that's a very common symptom of excessive stress and could lead to further complications later.
And then what about the physical part of it? Because a lot of folks you know, are seeing the VOG and may have respiratory issues, and you know, you, if you're nearby, you can probably smell the gas. But this is now over a month, and what's the effect of that on a person's psyche?
Well, being a non-medical person, I'm going to give you the typical symptoms of excessive stress. And they can be from seeing or smelling, seeing the lava, smelling the fumes, seeing the ash, headaches, gastrointestinal problems, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, anger, irritability, cynicism, or being negative. These are all normal symptoms of excessive stress. Sleep and or appetite disturbance, sadness and depression, feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, worthlessness. So those are the kinds of symptoms that are common. Beyond that, somebody would need to see their medical professional.
Right. But then going back to that same advice then is, if you can, get away from it.
Right. I don't know enough about where is safer to be away from it, where is not. And so I would like to defer that to somebody who can better characterize where it might be safer for people in trying to feel some sense of, I guess, relief from those physical consequences of the eruption, right? Because you may move far away, say to another part of the Big Island, but you may experience or feel an earthquake. And that earthquake may trigger you to have a very physical and mental health reaction, yeah, to that event that might be hard to get very far away from, yeah.
So I didn't even think about that, the aftershocks and that physical part of the stress on you.
Yep.
Anything else that you think would be important to stress right now for people going through this? Got a little bit of time.
Yes. I'd like to just reinforce the importance of being self-aware of your ability to cope with stress and being okay with admitting that you are not Superman or Wonder Woman and that you could use some help. And that help can be as simple as recognizing who is the person that makes you feel heard. And whoever that person may be, brother, sister, auntie, uncle, coach, kupuna, and just talk to someone, not a therapist per se, but if a therapist, that's fine. And just recognize that those feelings of being afraid and vulnerable and feeling so secure with your world, with your life, with your future, with your dreams, is very, very common.
Okay, so we understand the need, and all you need to do is reach out.
Yes.
Thanks so much for spending time with us. We have been talking with Troy Freitas, the state's Behavioral Health Disaster Coordinator, about addressing the mental health needs of our neighbors displaced by this latest eruptive phase of Kilauea Volcano.
Support for today's programming comes from Bishop Museum, presenting Holo Moana, Generations of Voyaging, exploring the story of how an ancestral practice has been reactivated by Hawaiian and oceanic voyagers over the past five decades, now through June 24th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a look at continuing relief efforts on Kauai. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of a certain replicated Buddhist temple and the original it was modeled on. Nestled at the foot of the Ko'olau Mountains in the back of Kaneohe's Valley of the Temples, the structure we're thinking about is not technically a functioning temple with an active congregation. The site has all the trappings of a Buddhist holy site. Its centerpiece features an 18-foot golden Buddha and a 3-ton brass peace bell that hangs on the temple grounds. The temple itself is surrounded by a massive wraparound koi pond and a lush Japanese garden. The location has always been used in several TV shows, including Lost, Magnum T.I., P.I., and both iterations of Hawaii 5-0. But as massive and awe-inspiring as it is, the Byodo Inn Temple was actually only a half-size replica of an even larger temple. What is the name of the original temple? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. The flood that devastated Kauai in April, claiming hundreds of homes, is no longer in the headlines day to day, but its long-term effects are still being felt, and for many, recovering is only beginning. A great many people on that island need help, and Malama Kauai Executive Director Megan Fox is on the phone to give us an update. Good morning, Megan.
Morning, Chris. How are you?
Oh, I'm not bad. You've been coordinating volunteers to help out, and how many people roughly need help on Kauai right now as a result of the flood?
Yeah, tough question. There's hundreds, really. So the initial cleanup efforts, I think, and response efforts had a lot of volunteers across the island. And it's really not just us. It's, you know, hundreds of people that are coordinating volunteers at different homes and farms and businesses across the island. And it's starting to hit a little bit of a lull here with volunteers. So just as we're getting into more of the bigger projects, like the rebuilding, there's been this drop off of volunteers. So it's kind of bringing up this extra need right now, especially for highly skilled volunteers like mechanics or electricians, plumbers, carpenters, those kind of things too.
What are some of the most urgent needs, Megan?
I think just homes for people, making sure they have somewhere safe to live, mm-hmm. is really critical. I think on the bigger scale, we're going to see a really major drop-off in taro across the state because a lot of the taro farms were hit pretty badly as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of things can be focused on? You know, if you had an infusion of volunteers tomorrow, what kind of work would you get them doing?
You know, there's kind of captains or community leads in each part of the island who are working on rebuilding efforts for their area. And they each have different meetup points and times that people can just show up ready to work with some boots and gloves. And they're deploying pretty much every day out to different homes to help them, whether it's set up temporary homes outside of their houses so that they have somewhere safe and dry and out of the mold for them to sleep while their home gets repaired. There's a few, you know, probably a couple handfuls of complete demolition rebuilds on homes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be a large variety of things. We're also doing an ag internship program this summer and doing work days at different farms across the island to help them kind of get back on their feet a little faster with extra hands too.
In the case of a flooded home, you mentioned mold, and that's the kind of thing that a couple of months down the line when a home has been flooded becomes a really serious problem, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's been people that have had to go to the hospital with respiratory infections, pneumonia, different sicknesses related to the flooding and being in those kind of environments, especially if people have kids. It's really, you know, sensitive, or kupuna too. You really have to be careful about that. So getting people into places that are safe is really critical.
Are there people, you know, without access to that now? Is everyone finding some sort of shelter?
For the most part, and the county's been really useful in allowing kind of temporary sheltering at camps on the island. People have been setting up. Megan Wong up in Honolulu has been really great, leading lots of different work crews, and Samaritan's Purse is kind of an off-island relief organization that came through. And they've been really good about setting up temporary homes for people, whether it's on their land. We've had a homing hotline, and we've been able to line up some temporary places for people to stay. Honolulu Colony Resort, which is the only hotel up in the area that's shut off with the road access and the convoys. And they've been opening up their rooms temporarily for people while their homes get worked on or rebuilt in the process, too. So everyone's just really coming together to make sure nobody gets left behind.
And that particular resort, you said the road is cut off?
Yeah, so the road's cut off around Lumahai
mm-hmm.
or Waikoko, which is just after Waipa. And then they're only allowing residents or disaster relief agencies and contractors and things. You have to get a pass, and they have specific convoy times that you can kind of get in and out of the area. So they're keeping tourism out of the area and really kind of respecting the time that people need to heal and get their lives back on track.
It also sounds, Megan, as if the kind of volunteer help that you need has to be pretty specific to the work in that area. You mentioned a skilled labor volunteer sign-up that you folks are doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, any volunteers are helpful at this point. It's dropped off so much, and there's so many big projects happening that any able-bodied person is incredibly welcome to join the effort.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're having a shortage of is those more skilled volunteers that might be able to lead others that are newer to that task. There's a lot of farm machinery and vehicles that need a lot of mechanical work. People's electrical and plumbing and carpentry, you know, those more specific skill sets. So we did get a permission from the county to set up temporary camping at our farm in Kalihiwai. So that way we can try to hopefully attract some more off-island skilled laborers that might be willing to come out and volunteer, and we can house them and feed them at least, and mm-hmm. if they want to come and give back.
Well, it sounds as if there's a pretty broad-based effort. You've got a transportation sign-up, a skilled labor sign-up that I mentioned, and just a Facebook group for kind of general volunteers. But as you said, anybody who can help is going to be welcome to you folks.
Yeah, I mean, even cooks, they're doing a Meals on Wheels program up on the North Shore with Paulina and Jessica Lindman, and they're looking for people to help cook meals 3 days a week and get them out to the families that don't have anywhere to cook, too.
Well, Megan, we'll, you know, maybe some people will hear this and head your way. We certainly wish you luck in that volunteer
we hope so.
What's that?
I said we hope so.
Yeah, well, I hope so, too. Megan, thanks very much for talking with us. Megan Fox is the executive director of Malama Kauai. You can learn more about volunteer opportunities on the Garden Isle through our conversation Facebook page.
Tales of tragic love, of bullies and bears, and of the goddess Pele? Hear all of them told by master storyteller Jeff Gere in HPR's intimate Atherton studio on Saturday, the 23rd. Enjoy fresh tales on an old tongue by calling 955-8821 during business hours or going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Political rhetoric has a way of heating up as campaign season moves on. Already, two Hawaii candidates have sought injunctive relief from campaign opponents, and one has been the target of a very personal smear. Have we reached a new low in Hawaii campaigns, or has politics always been a blood sport? Columnist Denby Fawcett has looked into Hawaii's past for some examples. She has them in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Denby.
Good morning, Chris.
That question, you got a couple of different answers to that question that you asked, has it always been like this, didn't you?
Yes. Well, it's very interesting looking back as far back as the Hawaiian Royals. I mean, it seems much rougher then than it is today, if you can imagine. But when Queen Emma ran against David Kalakaua for the right to rule the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1874, she lost the election by quite a bit, and her supporters then mobbed the courthouse where the lawmakers had voted to pick David Kalakaua, and they beat up the Kalakaua supporters. They were called the Emmaites, and they beat them up so severely that 13 had head wounds, and then they even threw one of the Kalakaua supporters out of the second story window of the courthouse, and when he fell down to the ground, the mob then attacked him and beat him up some more. So it's quite different, quite more severe.
You make today's campaign sound downright civilized, but we've seen some pretty acrimonious stuff already this year, haven't we?
Yes. Well, Andrea Tupola, a Republican candidate for governor, had been she alleged smeared and cyberbullied over the period of a year by a Republican from a splinter group, Eric Ryan, who has a couple of Facebook pages and had done caricatures of her and also spoken about her father, who's a retired state judge, and her husband, who's a police officer, in a way that she felt was unfair and wrong. So she sought injunctive relief in district court and was granted a restraining order against Eric Ryan.
Part of that is, you know, it used to be that families were considered off limits no matter how ugly a campaign got, right?
Well, no, they've never been off limits because Frank Fossey, you know, our Honolulu mayor for almost two decades, he was attacked as a spouse abuser.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was like pretty strong going against someone's family. I think political attacks, they're meant to be personal and meant to be hurtful. So I don't think anything's ever been off limits.
Well,
and then you mentioned someone else seeking injunctive relief. That is not exactly correct. That's Clayton Hee, who says he's contemplating a slander suit against a super PAC that's been running signs linking him to domestic violence, which he says is untrue. And this goes back to a court document of his divorce 30 years ago in 1989, I guess.
So he hasn't yet sought. He's been saying that's
a
possibility.
Yes, and with that, you don't know. I mean, how serious he is. He says he's talking to attorneys that he knows to see, you know, what the possibility that would be. And he said his goal with that is to bring out who's behind the signs. But the woman who's the head of the super PAC says she's quite open about it, that it's her and her friends and no other outside political person.
Well, I suspect this is, we're only just getting warmed up. We're not even really in that serious a campaign.
Yes,
season.
I think because we have some very contested races in the primary. A gubernatorial race between Colleen Hanabusa and incumbent David Ige, and then the first congressional district. So these are high stakes, and, you know, hang on.
Yeah,
probably
right.
More.
Where the stakes are high, the rhetoric gets pretty heated. Thanks very much, Denby. That was columnist Denby Fawcett with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Shade conditions can be ideal for many things to grow. Architect Dean Sakamoto, founder of the Shade Institute, Sustainable Humanitarian Architecture and Design for the Earth. He's here to join us. He joins us live to talk about a new creative lab space on Richard Street. So, Dean, you've been involved in a couple of projects now, kind of empowering communities, right? You did Chinatown, Waipahu, and now the focus is what, River Street?
Yes, Catherine, that's correct. We're working with the Riverwalk community, or the former Kukui redevelopment area from the 1960s.
And so tell us, what's involved in this process?
Well, what's involved is making the area stakeholders, which include property owners, business owners, and residents, and people who just hang out around the Riverwalk and its various city parks, aware of this opportunity to organize, to create a district, improvement district by city ordinance, which will enable future physical improvements to make it more safer, more lively, more economically productive area, and right. A nice place for tourists as well.
Right, and that area I know has been problematic. They've had a lot of gamblers that kind of hang out in that area. It's been an area for crime when we had I think the overhang and that the area was kind of a magnet for all kinds of problems.
Well, yeah. If we just leave the place as is, you're going to have people who find other creative activities to happen there. I say creative because you know it's a free country and people can do whatever they want, whether it's illicit or legal. We're looking to make it more accessible for everyone. And especially the people who live and work in the area, which, by the way, will include American Savings Bank, which is bringing, what I hear, 600 employees to the area at their new corporate campus.
So you want to be able to make it an area that's inviting for the people that work there, maybe on their lunch hour, to go down there, take a stroll?
Yes, for sure. Definitely for the bank. And I also should mention that there's also Hawaii USA Credit Union, who's there, and they have about 200 employees, and they're wonderful temples, they're cultural amenities there, like the Azuma Taisha temple that's there, and they get visited heavily by Japanese tourists who come to get blessed and locals alike. Lumsai Ho Tong, which is a Chinese American temple, and it's heavily visited. And of course, we have the Cultural Plaza, the Chinese Cultural Plaza, which is in that area.
Yeah, I was amazed. I took the downtown Chinatown tour and learned about the temple there and how the lines of visitors, Japanese visitors, really snakes around the area during the New Year's. Well, that was a little bit of I think our current history that I wasn't even aware of, because I don't often walk down there. But it really kind of just gave me kind of opened up my eyes as to what's happening and the possibilities for that little stretch of Chinatown.
Yes, on a daily basis, you have buses of tourists to see Izumo Taisha in particular. And I was there also on New Year's Day, and there's a line going, like you said, around the block onto Baritania Street. But the question is, where else do people go aside from their destination on the Riverwalk? And when you think about the geography of Nu'uanu Stream, which is the tributary of the Nu'uanu Ahupua'a, which continues up to the Pali, this riverside continues alongside Vineyard, under Vineyard Avenue. It goes up under H1 Freeway up to Liliuokalani Gardens and up through the Pali. The Riverwalk itself is a city park from Baritania Street up to the freeway on both sides with Foster Garden. And Kuan Yin Temple also is in Foster Garden. So it's a tremendous cultural and even spiritual amenity, and it could be an economic asset as well. When you think what's coming in a few years with the rail station over on Kekaulike and Nimitz, so that really would be a true urban space that connects mass transit with Chinatown as a main attraction up through the natural feature of the Nu'uanu Stream into the Pali.
So you're hoping to get not just the people that work down there, but live in that area, to get involved and come talk about what's possible.
Yes. We call them stakeholders. It's kind of a technical term, but all that means is people who have a stake in a place and who care about a place. And, it could be tied to your livelihood if you own property or if you own a business in that area, if you live there. But also if you have memories, if you grew up in that area, and few people... Well, I guess you have to be my age or older to remember, but that area, the Kukui area, used to be a lively neighborhood that was deemed a slum by the federal government and the city at the time. And it was a place, it was an urban renewal site where federal money came in and was able to demolish all of the residential stock, which was the Chinatown residential, the residential extension of Chinatown, and to build pretty much what you see there today, which is single-use zoning. We have high-rise housing. We have, areas for temples and mortuaries. But the trend now is to have a more mixed use, to make a more vital environment. And maybe that's something we should talk about at this workshop, is how we can recognize the past, what worked in the past, what didn't work, what's working now, what's not working. And we're just doing these workshops to get people's input and to help them think about the possibilities of organizing. And then the physical improvements really cannot happen without some kind of an organization like a special improvement district.
And you worked on a project in Waipahu. Talk about that briefly.
Okay, so we've worked on a number of things in Waipahu. The first I'll say very quickly, because it was really a nice collaboration working with the city's transit-oriented district planning group led by Harrison Rue and his planners, and also a private firm, PBR Hawaii, where we helped with the Waipahu action plan, which worked with the town center of Waipahu, people around the center of Waipahu, to visualize what is possible and coming up with easy solutions to make improvements in preparation for the rail, which is physically already there. It's not operational, but the station mm-hmm. is almost built. So kind of working with that historic neighborhood in transition, because as we know, Sugar Cane left Waipahu over 20 years ago. And so the question is, what next? Will rail be an answer? Now, the second project we're working on in Waipahu is with two major stakeholders, Waipahu High School is one, and the other is the Waipahu Aloha Clubhouse, which is a State Department of Health adult day center for adults with mental disabilities. We've been working with them, and our champion for that project is Mary Pat Waterhouse, who is a good friend and was on the board of the clubhouse, and who has been advocating with this between the city and state to build a safe sidewalk for safe passage to the clubhouse and the high school from Farrington Highway, where most of the members of the clubhouse and many of the school students have to walk almost a quarter mile. And there's no sidewalks on Waipio Point Access Road. It's a windy and kind of a dangerous road that's overgrown with junk cars on it. So over the last two and a half years, our summer shade summer program, which attracts students, university level students in the planning and design fields from around the world now, to spend 10 weeks with us, and they worked on that, and so we're working towards taking that through technical design drawings, and possibly realizing it in the coming year.
Okay, so those are just examples of what the community can do, and that's the whole point of this upcoming workshop on Thursday. And if folks want to come down, that's a little bit, it's in the evening. It's an evening event, so folks can join you then.
Yes, 5 to 7, and all of our events are held at what's called the Shade City Lab, which is at 850 Richards Street, the corner of Richards and Merchant. And it was provided to us generously by the Yangtze Foundation,
okay,
who owns the building.
All right, well, thanks very much for joining us, Dean. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. That was architect Dean Sakamoto of the Shade Institute. Again, that event on Thursday is free and open to the public this Thursday night at its new lab space on Richard Street. You can listen back to the full story on the conversation page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Aloha, I'm Ruth Fletcher from St. Andrew's Schools. We represent the Priory, the Prep, and Queen Emma Preschool. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. And as usual, we are so lucky to have the expertise of Christopher Phillips to turn to, and we've got him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, familiar planetary visitors to our island skies, include Jupiter and Saturn, both of which can be seen after sunset in the east, along with Mars a little later at 10 p.m., also in the east. The moon this week is passing through its new moon phase, and so skies will be nice and dark, perfect for appreciating the celestial wonders that our galaxy has to offer.
And speaking of those celestial wonders, last week, big news from NASA, or at least NASA billed it as such, and I think for fans of space exploration, they want to be enthusiastic when NASA does such a thing. And I understand you've got a little bit of detail on it, because it turned out, for I think for a lot of folks, to not be all that exciting.
Yes, it was news from the Energizer Bunny of Mars rovers, the Curiosity rover, and news that it had discovered evidence of methane in the Martian atmosphere, along with a second discovery of what they called organic molecules on the Martian surface.
Now, you'd like to get excited about this because it seems like this would be evidence of life, right?
Well, there's a huge disconnect between what scientists and the public define as organic, and it has led to some heated discussion on the matter. The scientific definition of organic is basically any kind of molecule with a carbon atom attached. So, for example, gasoline is organic, as is oil. And at a stretch, even plastic could be considered organic because it has organic polymers in other molecules. And I think that's where the confusion comes from.
It takes away from the excitement of the whole process, too, because I think when people get an announcement like this from NASA, they're expecting a result that is seemingly more out of this world.
Exactly. And I think it's all down to how NASA phrases these announcements and these conferences, especially when they build up so much hype around these announcements.
And finally, the methane. And finally, what you like to call methane, but the rest of us in America call methane. What's the thoughts on that?
Well, methane, or methane, does come as part of the metabolic process in life, but it also comes from geology, and that is what Curiosity seems to have found.
Well, we'll be hoping for another update at some point in our lifetime that's a little bit more exciting. We'll be rooting NASA on, and yourself, Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And Stargazer is kept on demand at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary, designing more than 2,000 projects since 1988. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
For today's backyard quiz, we asked you about the Biruin Temple in Kaneohe Valley's Valley of the Temples and the building it was modeled on. The original was completed in 1052 and is regarded as one of Japan's national treasures. In 1968, a replica was commissioned in Hawaii to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the first Japanese immigrants to the islands. Governor John A. Burns oversaw the dedication in recognition of his longtime support of Japanese rights during Hawaii's territorial years. And while you're more likely nowadays to find peddlers offering souvenirs instead of monks offering prayer, the temple serves as a strong cultural link between Hawaii and Japan. Today's quiz was a trick question. In addition to sharing the identical architectural scheme, albeit at half the size scale, the Biruin Temple in Hawaii shares the same name as the Biruin Temple in Japan.
And Catherine Lila Shar of downtown Honolulu got that right. She was the first caller to get the right answer. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for students' summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The years after the Civil War were years of disappointment for the newly freed slaves of the American South, when their promised freedom encountered a bitter backlash and the migration to the North and West began. The play Flyin' West is the story of four women who found their way to the all-black town of Nicodemus, Kansas, in the late 19th century, reminding us that the women we see as pioneers today had some powerful predecessors. Jeanne Wynn Herring is directing an upcoming performance at Manoa Valley Theater, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
What was it about this story that made you want to direct this play?
Well, it's an exciting story. First of all, I'm originally from Kansas, so I have very much of a personal connection to this story. Also, it is part of a national project, so I didn't get a chance to pick this play. It was picked by a gentleman by the name of Eric McMillan McCall in New York, and it just was a coincidence that he picked this play 2 years before, prior to the election, prior to the Me Too movement, and it turned out to be the perfect play for anyone to relate to. It gives a lot of hope, a lot of pride to women.
Yeah.
It gives a lot of hope and a lot of pride to African Americans, and gives a lot of hope and a lot of pride to Americans as a whole. And it's a story that gives hope, and it's a story to give us valuable knowledge about our history.
What's the story of Nicodemus, Kansas?
Nicodemus, Kansas is actually an all-black town. It is the last of the all-black towns that survived. And it was established in 1877. It was the first all-black town that was established after the Civil War. And it is known as the town that brought several blacks from the South and into Kansas. Kansas is actually known as the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
And it offered freedom, true freedom to the blacks.
Kansas was also known as Bloody Kansas.
It certainly was. And a little known fact, actually, Kansas was the reason for the Civil War.
You mean the whole controversy as to whether or not it would be a slave state?
Exactly.
Well, in such a hotbed of controversy, I'm amazed that an all-black town could survive. because they didn't always, and they ran into a lot of opposition in other parts of the country, right? I'm thinking of the black community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for example, which essentially was wiped out.
Exactly. I believe from the stories, I've been working directly with Angela Bates, who is a historian, and she runs the Historical Society in Nicodemus, Kansas. And from the talks I've had with her and from all my research, the big reason why Nicodemus survived as an all-black town was because of the strength of the women pioneers of mm-hmm. Nicodemus, Kansas. They refused to allow any of the whites who tried to take the land in Nicodemus, Kansas. They refused to allow them to take it. And they did whatever they could do to survive there in Nicodemus, Kansas, to keep the land theirs. And the play actually touches on that.
What kind of things could they do to keep the land under their own ownership?
Well, one of the things they could do was flat out refuse to sell it. Mm-hmm. They didn't fall for any of the tricks. Many of the tricks that are tried today to get people to sell land, to sell anything, the smooth talking that many people try, the intimidation. Women as a whole are very good at refusing to fall for intimidation, and it was no different back in the 19th century.
Do you think that is, Jeanne?
Women,
we've had so much practice.
We've had so much practice, that is definitely for sure. But I believe women, when we are very protective. I mean, it's because of our nurturing nature. Mm-hmm. We want to protect our family. And to protect our family, we will do what we have to do to protect our family. And our family doesn't just include our blood family, but our family includes our community. And we have to protect our community. When you look at the pride in, when you look at the lioness, they will protect their pride no matter what they have to do. Mm-hmm. And that I believe that that's true with all species.
You may well have something there. How does that play out in the action of the play Flyin' West?
Well, I can't really tell you too much because that'll give away lots of surprises, and you'll have to come and see the play to find out.
Well, give me a hint. You know, lots of people listening aren't going to be able to make it. So.
Well, one hint is this. As a man, be careful on how you disrespect women.
Uh-huh.
And, if I can tell you much more than that, then you'll...
I think I can get enough of a hint from that.
Exactly.
But how much of this is based on research?
Much of the playwright Pearl Cleese, she wrote this play based off of a journal that she found about Nicodemus, Kansas. That was actually written by one of the women in Nicodemus, Kansas. So much of this is based on true occurrences. Much of it is fictionalized, but it is based on what went on in Nicodemus, Kansas.
What do you think an audience can take away from this?
Hope. They can take away hope. Also, what I find very important about this play is the idea that we look at slavery and we want to hang on to anger. But what we need to take away from this is the fact that the slaves, they did not hang on to anger. What they did was they took their experiences and they focused forward and they left us a legacy so that all of us could have opportunity. And that is what we need to focus on. We need to focus on the legacy that was left for us, build upon that, so that we can leave a legacy for generations after us.
You might argue that each generation has a little bit less, perhaps, to be angry about when you think of the kind of things that were around the struggles of a black community in the 1870s. This is really the birth of the backlash, the beginnings of lynching, the KKK, and you know, retaliation when the whole Reconstruction effort started to sour.
Right. You can argue that, of course, but people are still going to be angry. And anger is not a bad thing if you use it for the right reasons. Go ahead and get angry, but don't be destructive. Be productive with your anger.
Anger tends to be self-destructive.
Exactly. Exactly, and you can't do that. If you're going to be angry, do not fall for the tricks of the anger that people are inducing. People, if you notice, they're exploiting our anger. And what I want people to take away from this play is that get angry, but take action. Take the right actions with your anger.
An angry opponent can sometimes be a disarmed opponent.
Right, exactly.
And that's would seem to be one of the lessons here. I would imagine that the women in this play, Flying West, had a great deal to subdue in terms of an angry reaction.
That is correct, but you also have to recognize that they were in the Wild West. And the difference between the Wild West and today is what they had to use, the lack of tools that they had.
Pretty much absence of the rule of law.
Exactly.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Janae Wynn Herring is the director of the play Flying West by Pearl Clegg, to be performed the evening of June 18th at Manoa Valley Theater. You can get details on our conversation Facebook page. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, a panel discussion of U.S.-North Korea relations in the wake of yesterday's summit.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, record your comments. The number to do that, 792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or what a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.